Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we are coming to you from the spin room of the Democratic primary debate in Houston. That's right, we are here on the ground in Houston. You can probably hear some of the noise in the background. The candidates have just come out to talk to the press, but we're going to talk to you guys. For the first time, the top Democrats debated on a single stage on a single night, and it was a long night, about 3 hours. So we are here to break it all down for you. And here to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Howdy.
Long night?
You know what? Major League Baseball has been trying to prevent games from going more than 2 hours and 45 minutes, and I think there was a reason for that.
Fair enough. And also here with us is politics editor Sarah Frostenson. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Galen.
And Nathaniel Rakich, our elections analyst. Other Nate, I don't know that you've been on this podcast at the same time as Nate Silver before.
So we have Spider-Man. What's the Spider-Man?
Nate Squared.
GIF. Spider-Man's face.
This is a 50% Nathaniel podcast, so
50%
you're all on notice.
Podcast are called Nathaniel. That is true. All right, let's get to the point. Nate, we'll start with you. I want to hear everybody's top line takeaway from the debate. Take it away.
My top line takeaway is that the second tier candidates had a stronger night than the first tier candidates.
Ooh, hot take. Tell us more.
I mean, look, I'm not going to try to create big coherent themes when there aren't any necessarily, and so just kind of go through person by person, right? You know, Biden has been a pattern, I think, starts out strong in the first half an hour to an hour, and then I don't know if you want to call it loses steam or gets trapped up or something, but like the last couple of answers he gave were pretty incoherent after I thought he did very well actually in the first half and kind of beat back, I think, Warren and Sanders on the healthcare portion of the debate, but will people kind of remember the first impression, the last impression? I don't know, but it was certainly not a very crisp night from start to finish.
All right, let's get to some of the other lesser candidates, but I want to get to you, Sarah Frostenson. What was your top line takeaway?
My top line takeaway, I think Nate's right. The lower tier candidates did do well. I'm just not convinced that's going to be enough to actually see anything in the polls. And so like my priors for that is after the first debate we found in our poll with Morning Consult, Castro had a huge jump in his net favorability. He was the last to qualify for tonight's stage. He did it 8 days before the debate cutoff on August 28th. It's just like I don't see O'Rourke or Klobuchar, though they were great tonight, actually seeing a bump in the polls.
Right. So you can sort of build your favorability and get people to like you, but not actually support you to be the nominee.
That's my thought. I mean, Klobuchar, she's actually behind Yang right now in the polls and has less qualifying polls for October. So I just don't see in what world that's changing dramatically. Maybe a few bumps in the poll, but like I don't think significantly.
Yeah, right. I agree, Sarah. Like I just think that, you know, with all these debates, we want there to be something big that happens, and it's just not always going to happen. And I think the first debate kind of spoiled us in that way because there was something big that happened tonight. Maybe you got that with the way that Biden and Castro got into it, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, but I think ultimately, yeah, my prior is that things are going to stay the same.
Wait, so is your top line takeaway then, Nathaniel, nothing big happened tonight?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
all right.
Hashtag ratings.
Hey, the debate's over. The ratings are done.
But we want people to listen to this podcast, though.
Oh, sure.
Stay tuned. It's going to be riveting analysis of an unremarkable debate.
Hang on. Something big just happened here in the spin room, and we're only going to discuss it at the end of the podcast.
There you go. Okay. So let's get back to this idea that the lesser candidates kind of had a better night. Who are we talking about there?
Klobuchar.
Beto.
Booker.
I guess Yang. He didn't do bad.
He was fine.
I mean, I thought his gambit at the beginning was good, right?
I think that was smart, and I think he's going to get a lot of the contact information out of it from all the people who entered the raffle, but
explain,
I think it got lost. So
12 families, right?
Yeah, so basically Yang, I think it was 10 families, okay. But $12,000 a year. Basically, Yang announced that he would give his universal basic income proposal to 10 families selected at random who enter his drawing, which I think, again is very smart because the people have to give him their contact information.
The catch, they have to live in a house together. Their activities are recorded.
And the democracy dollars, maybe that was less of a hit.
But I just think that by the end of the debate, that got overwhelmed. So, like, I think it was smart of them to leak it a little bit early, so it got a little bit of buzz early on, but it's not going to be the story out of the debate.
All right, so you had Yang, Y, Klobuchar, Booker, and Beto.
I mean, I think Klobuchar had not been very good in the first two debates, and she was just quite consistent tonight and a little bit more assertive about saying, hey, look, I'm someone who wants to be present for all the country and kind of playing in that moderate lane, but invoking themes of electability without kind of being quite so explicit about it. And Booker has just been good at these things, I think, in general. Beto is more where you have the high highs. I mean, the answer on gun control, yeah, I do want to take away your AK-47s. I'm getting these guns right, and AR-15s. And, you know, I guess when you're polling at 3%, then you can afford to take a few more risks. But, like, that is a popular stance among Democrats. It was a debate in Texas. You had a lot of candidates who were, like, happy to praise him for his response to the El Paso shootings. And then, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to let Rakich make the case for the...
I boldly make the case for the Beto surge person. I mean, look, I just think that Beto O'Rourke is clearly a talented politician. He's shown that. I think he showed that with his answers tonight. He had that viral video on race and the national anthem during his 2018 campaign, and he raised a ton of money and got a ton of grassroots interest in that campaign. And I just don't think we've heard the last of him. People, I think, are underestimating him right now. He's low enough in the polls that he's kind of flown under the media's radar, and the media was pretty critical of him early in the campaign. You saw that somebody like Pete Buttigieg, who just kind of looks like Beto, did well. So I think there is an appetite out there for that kind of candidate. So I just wouldn't be shocked if he, you know, has another moment. I'm not sure that this debate will do it because I don't think he stood out quite that much. But yeah, that's my case.
So we started off this podcast with Nate saying Biden did fine to start with, then stumbled later in the podcast. Sorry, not the podcast. Later in the debate,
it's
they were
a long
not
podcast.
Recording a 3-hour podcast.
If we do a 3-hour podcast, I would get worse.
I think Galen
I think that's actually totally fair.
I would get drunk. That's what I would do. Sarah, let me ask you. One of the dynamics we were describing in the run-up to this debate is that there are a lot of candidates out there basically hoping that Biden falls apart, and then they can take up that moderate mantle. Did anything happen tonight that would make us think that somebody else can come in and fill the Joe Biden's moderate shoes?
So, I mean, he did have the gaffe, right, about the record player in response to trying to talk about institutional racism in the country and, like, how do you handle that? But that, as we've said here tonight, was kind of on par for the course, how he's fallen apart in previous debates. I mean, Klobuchar had a strong performance. She's someone who you could argue would fill that moderate lane well, but I don't think that he did anything differently tonight that was somehow unusual in comparison to the first two debates where someone swoops in now to benefit from that.
I'm not even sure that that would qualify as a gaffe, Sarah. I mean, I think that, you know, he was making a valid point about playing music for kids, and I think that it does...
It was also a hard question.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic or not.
I mean...
Oh.
No, yeah.
It was, you're not being sarcastic.
No, I mean, he went off topic, but I mean, I think the point... I think the people will see that the point he was making was valid, but I think people... The record... No.
Hot.
I'm getting a lot of weird
looks.
That's a hot take.
I mean, the whole answer
was...
Anyway, the record,
the fact that he said record player and not music or something, I think is what's going to get the most attention.
Yeah, because that's the sound bite, but it's
right,
representative of something broader.
I say I'm not sure that I think that other than that, that question was that bad.
Let's turn to Bernie Sanders, who was audibly hoarse throughout the evening and spoke the third least of any of the candidates on stage.
Inaudibly hoarse? Does that count?
Yeah, if you're hoarse and you just don't speak.
Okay.
Which is the option he chose for part of the debate because he spoke the third fewest words. In any case, how did he perform given that he didn't speak a lot and when he did, he was hoarse?
I mean, I thought it was maybe the worst debate I've seen him have, but I don't know how much of that is the hoarseness and the fact that, like, it does make him sound older and, like, he was not particularly sharp on the healthcare exchange early on. I think later on he... gave an answer about the filibuster that is a little esoteric as a topic, but like is something that doesn't really kind of make sense for you pushing for political revolution, but now you want to have 60 votes for things or go through reconciliation. You know, again, Bernie has this narrow range of performances, and it kind of ranges from like a B+ to a C+, the occasional A- maybe, and I thought this was like a C+, but you know, I don't think it's going to be like fatal or anything.
Well, I would push back on the filibuster idea just in the sense that his idea is keep the filibuster, but we'll do it all through budget reconciliation, which is essentially then the parliamentarians like, yeah, we'll just put that in the bill and push it through. In some ways, I think that's just as radical. But, you know, in one way, it's, oh, we'll maintain decorum by the 60 votes. And I don't know. It's just no one gave a real answer, though, despite being pushed multiple times by the moderators on how will you actually get X big progressive idea through Congress. And now the new solution is like get rid of the filibuster or just ram it through a budget reconciliation bill. Like that's not going to work.
Okay, so we've gone through Biden and Sanders. How'd Elizabeth Warren do?
She's fine.
Yeah, pretty well. Good.
I
she
mean,
did
like
her
if it's
normal thing.
If it's this big, if it was supposed to be this big kind of coming out party for her, I'm not sure she had that. You know, I thought early on, like, so one thing, she has this whole, I have a plan for that tagline brand, right? She does sometimes get away with giving very politician-y answers, right? I mean, she gave kind of slippery answers on, like, how are you going to pay for, not how are you going to pay for, but, like, well, yeah.
Yeah, they said, would, how are you going to pay for your health care?
The middle
plan?
Class have tax raises as part of your health care plan, right?
It was a very was effective quite, answer, though.
I don't think it was effective at all.
Really?
I think it was quite evasive, and Biden, to his credit, who has not always been sharp tackling these debates, came back around and said, yeah, that was evasive, right?
Yeah, and the reason that I thought that it was strong is that I think it was clearly a, you know, it was an effort to get Warren to say that their plan would, the healthcare plan would raise taxes for Medicare for all, but she made the point that, you know, Bernie has made, I think, more explicitly that the taxes might go up, but the families would pay less in premium, so it would save the money overall. And she basically avoided answering the questions and said the quote, costs would go down. And I thought it was an effective way, but I agree with Nate that it was politician-y, and then she does get away with saying politician-y things because she kind of has a fairly charming and every woman-y affect to it.
The first 15 minutes of the debate were when we finally saw that three-way fight that we've been waiting to see, which was between Biden, Sanders, and Warren. None of the other candidates spoke during that first 15 or so minutes of the debate. If you had to pick who came out strongest from that, who do you think it was?
Biden.
Biden.
Yeah, I was going to say Biden, too.
From that first part?
From the,
first 15 minutes where nobody else was speaking. They just had to let the top three kind of
have it
out.
Oh, from the first part? I thought that was Biden's best 15 minutes of any of the three debates.
Agree.
But it was 15 minutes in a three-hour debate, and I don't think he was the strongest of the three throughout the balance of the debate.
I don't think Sanders' like repeated use of, like, hey, Joe, like, was that effective? Just like, I don't know if Castro's attacks really will have landed. I think we'll see his
Why is that?
I think, because we also saw that more tonight, right? Like, Harris had this 1.2 where she started off by giving credit to the Obama administration before she then, like, pivoted and launched into attack. And I think Democrats tonight on the stage were much more willing to not put Obama's record under the spotlight as much as they have in the previous two debates. And so if you're Biden, you benefit from that.
What was the effect of having only one debate with the top 10 candidates and having people who have been on the debate stage, in particular moderates like Bullock, Bennett, or Delaney, not present?
I think it helped the other, you know, kind of the also-rans, as Nate said. I think someone like Amy Klobuchar really benefits from, you know, just basically the quote-unquote moderate lane is down to Biden and her, I guess.
Which is sort of what it's supposed to do, right? Like,
right.
I don't think the DNC would say it explicitly, but they're going to say, like, okay, that group of candidates, Booker, Klobuchar, Castro, and maybe Beto. I mean, Beto was only a representative and not a senator or a cabinet member, but, like, very kind of pretty well-qualified group of candidates. And when you have the Delaneys on stage and the Marianne Williamsons and whatever else, then it gets hard for them to have a word in edgewise, right? So they had sustained engagement tonight, and it did seem to benefit them. And so, you know, I don't really expect to see very dramatic things happen in the polls, but maybe. I mean, we'll test the theory where you have one night's worth of narratives and not two nights. You don't, I mean, we'll see. I don't think there's going to be like a, oh, Bernie Sanders had a great night or narrative or whatever. I don't think we're going to have even a Warren had a great night narrative, although I think people obviously who like Warren will like how she did. You know, I don't know. I mean, look, we just briefly talked about Harris, but I don't know what she's doing in these things.
Elaborate.
Her style is just very weird.
Wait, you have to say more. You have to say more than what makes it weird.
There's something very spacey about it and circuitous about it, right? Where she kind of will kind of loop around and not answer questions directly and like kind of speak kind of literally like kind of slowly and like there's something weird about it. Also, I thought she was like kind of effective in attacking Biden in the first debate. Apparently, you know, she thought, well, maybe this, the collapse of the surge that we had after Biden was a proof that like, or after the first debate was proof that like it didn't help, but like, I mean, we had this debate on the Monday podcast. So you can go back and listen to that, right? At least she had a surge. Even if she lost most of that surge eventually, at least something clicked for her, right? You know, I think her answers on, like, her prosecutorial record are not very helpful, where she's kind of not really owning it. And it could be a strength. You could say, yeah, it was tough on crime. We have to be tough on crime. But it was also trying to recognize the fact there's been historic institutional racism in the system and blah, 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 right? But, like,
It's funny. I actually see Kamala Harris's traveling press secretary standing right over there behind you, Nate. We could ask her, but I guess we'll keep podcasting instead.
Okay, yeah. but look, could I see the easiest way I could see in the short term a surge for one of their candidates is like if Kamala Harris keeps kind of collapsing back to like 3% in the polls, and if her fundraising number in Q3 is really disappointing, then you could say people saying, well, you know what, I'm not quite ready to have, because I think there is a market for Democrats who are not quite ready to say it's either one of these leftists or it's a 70, how old is Biden?
Well, all of the three front runners are septuagenarians.
Yes, although I do think like 70 is pretty materially different when you have a woman from a 76 or 77 year old man. I do think it's pretty different. And so I don't necessarily draw the line right there. But still, you know, if Harris decided tomorrow to withdraw for reasons unrelated to her competitiveness in the race, right, then I think you would see some effort by party elites, as we call them, slash certain types of Democratic voters, slash the media to anoint like a fourth challenger. That's kind of what it feels like.
What do you guys think? Who would fill those shoes?
I mean, I guess if you look at her as having appeal to multiple coalitions, lots of endorsements, you almost see Booker filling that because he has a similar background in terms of lots of endorsements from within the party. But I don't think he had a particularly strong performance tonight. So then, honestly, I think maybe Biden benefits if she drops out because they also have a lot of overlap in voters. Then again, she also does with Warren. But I don't know. I don't see an heir apparent.
I just think it's too early to say.
Yeah. There's more I want to get to, so let's continue this conversation in just a minute. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Legacy Box. We all have old home videos and photos that don't get much play in our digital world. Well, now you can get those all easily digitized with Legacy Box. With Legacy Box, you can save your family films and photos from degrading or being lost forever. If you can't play your recordings because you don't have a VCR anymore, well, now you can. Just send in your legacy box filled with old home movies and pictures, and they'll do the rest, professionally digitizing your moments onto a thumb drive, digital download, or DVD. Over 450,000 families have trusted Legacy Box. They have over a decade of experience, and all the work is done by hand right here in the USA. There's never been a better time to digitally preserve your memories. Visit LegacyBox.com today to get started. Plus, for a limited time, they're offering 538 listeners an exclusive discount. Go to LegacyBox.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters, to get 40% off your first order. Go to LegacyBox.com/538 to save 40% today. Get started preserving your past. All right, let's continue this conversation. So we're actually polling folks again. We did this after the first debate, and we're going to do it. We're doing it again with this debate. We poll a panel before the debate and then poll them again after to see how their views have changed of the candidates. We'll get back to that on the next Monday podcast because we weren't able to poll the whole panel in the 30 minutes since the debate ended, unfortunately. But Sarah, what's our starting point for how the panel that we looked at views the candidates?
So pretty much what our poll found is what you're going to see elsewhere at this point. So we didn't have a traditional horse race question, but we were asking respondents, well, of the candidates on tonight's stage, who are you considering? And of those top three, it was Biden, Warren, and Sanders. And then we also asked voters on a scale of 0 to 100 to tell us how likely it was that they thought a candidate would beat Trump. Again, that pretty much mirrored who's leading in the horse race polls. And then on the favorability, pretty much also what you would expect.
I find the question was, how likely do you think this person is to beat Trump, right? And then we just could see the whole curve according to and we asked respondents to give a percentage chance, right?
Correct.
How did people end up dealing with that kind of a poll question?
Well, people seemed reluctant to give much credit at all to candidates who they weren't familiar with, right? So if you look at like an Amy Klobuchar, who probably objectively, quote unquote, has a good electability case, she had like half people said 0% chance she beat Trump. So, you know, obviously
people are just like, oh, I don't know her.
Kind of ground zero for understanding Americans' misunderstanding of probabilities.
I actually
and the media. Let's not blame the public.
Well, I got to relitigate what 30% means on Twitter today.
That's
what it means to be work at 538.
But yeah, a lot of people are not very confident in candidates they don't know very well. And so, you know, maybe just by being like more of a presence tonight, that would help a Klobuchar or a Booker or something. It didn't feel like the sort of commanding performance by Warren. So right now, Warren is at like what? Voters give her a 51% chance of beating Trump, and Biden a 67% chance, roughly. What's
That's
Biden?
68.
You know, it didn't feel like...
This is according to our panel poll.
It didn't feel like a sort of commanding, very confident performance where she dominated, and maybe she needs, like, at one point, like a... I don't know. She doesn't need anything. I mean, she's...
But doesn't she
you know,
like if the
you're
status quo?
Up, yeah, maybe. But, like, we're taking for granted that if she... Yeah, okay. If you keep moving up a point every 2 weeks, then do the math, right? We have how many more weeks until Iowa,
you're doing
right?
the math. You're the okay. stats guy.
Okay.
5
cool
months.
Cool it. But, like, that'd be enough where, like, she is basically caught or slightly surpassed Biden nationally by Iowa, and then she'd be ahead in Iowa, and then, you know, but, like, but there's no guarantee that she'll keep gaining ground. In fact, if you want to be very mechanical about it, usually there's not much momentum in polling, right? Going from 10 to 15, well, the expectation is that you stay at 15 plus or minus some fairly large number. And so, you know, but she, I mean, look, I think she was, like, of the top four, the least bad.
Of the top four,
she wasn't
the
bad
least
at all.
Bad.
She was fine. She was good.
Who is the fourth in the top four? Buttigieg?
Harris.
I guess. Oh, that's bad that I. What were you going to say, Sarah?
Well, I was going to say, you know, on the subject of asking voters who they think could beat Trump, you know, O'Rourke's actually in fifth right now, according to our poll with Ipsos. And if he did have such a strong performance tonight, as we've all said, maybe we'll see movement there, or maybe we'll see it with Klobuchar. I think that'll be telling.
Yeah, I just don't think it was a very electability-focused debate. I think in some of the opening statements alluded to electability, but there wasn't an explicit question about it like there was last time. It was actually pretty issue-driven, which I thought was good. But for us to have asked that specific question, I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of movement in those answers when we get the later numbers.
Which is so crazy, because over 38% of people in our poll, we asked out of 17 issues, what is the most important to you? And it's a candidate's ability to beat Trump. And it's just, I don't know, I would have thought that would come in more to the debate, but instead it's like, how far to the left can we go on everything?
It's interesting. I think Nate mentioned at one point during the first debate that they should host just a purely electability-themed debate. And that would be...
An electability debate,
like debate
but no climate change debate.
For 1 hour.
For 1 hour. To your point about electability, it seemed like the opening statements were a bit more kind of kumbaya driven than we've seen from the first two debates. And it also seemed like there was just like a tension on stage between candidates who really wanted to hash it out over their left-leaning policies versus the moderate policies, and the more moderate candidates who were like, no, let's have party unity. You saw that interaction between Castro and Buttigieg when Buttigieg was kind of making this kumbaya appeal, and Castro was like, no, this is a primary. Like, this is where we fight about this stuff. What do voters want? Do we know?
I think it's good to create conflict and good in a, you know, 10-way race, formerly a 24-way race, I guess, to, like, to stand out and to take some risks. You know, I think Castro maybe is more likely to bear the downside of that risk today. Part of it is some of the initial reporting we're seeing is that, like, I have not gone back and reviewed, like, the transcript of whether Biden contradicted himself. You know, the reporting I'm reading is saying that actually he didn't, and that Castro was pointing out something that wasn't really there.
You're talking about a back and forth between Castro and Biden.
So almost kind of like Gillibrand's moment when she tried to take Biden to task in the second debate and was just kind of out of...
Wait, can you describe what went down?
Right so I thought this was actually one of the most interesting moments of the debate. And I think Castro generally, he was kind of the designated attack dog for Biden today. He scrapped with Biden on his health care plan and whether it would require people to opt in. And I think that actually the confusion may have been what I interpreted it as, was that Biden said that people would have to opt in, and or Castro said that they would have to buy in, and I don't think those are exactly the same thing. But basically, Castro accused Biden of forgetting what he had said just 2 minutes earlier, which, of course, is a thinly veiled attack at Biden's age. So that was interesting. And then later on in the debate, Castro also accused Biden of trying to have it both ways with the Obama legacy, saying that he was taking credit for the positive parts of Obama, but the not
which is
but
a,
avoiding
which is
blame.
A good critique.
I think that's a good critique. I think people are focusing on the age thing. I think like the cable news takeaway from this debate between the record player comment and the Castro attack is going to be on Biden's age, which I think is kind of a shame. And I think those were kind of two small parts of the debate. But I do think Castro.
Oh my gosh, this is triggering me. I think the age is a legitimate subject. And in fact, I think Castro erred by not just saying, dude, you're too old. Obviously, a little bit more delicate.
I think this is what it's going to come down to because I think
strategist and chief debate silver.
I think that Castro's comment came across as kind of mean and almost passive aggressive or just aggressively aggressive. Whereas he could have said, you know, look, like we need somebody in the White House who can respond quickly to things, and we need young or new generation, something like what Eric Swalwell said. And I think there's going to be a lot of debate about whether what Castro did was civil or not, or whether it crossed a line. And I could see it going either way, frankly.
Well, I mean, Kamala Harris gained like 7 points in the polls after she pretty aggressively went after Biden in the first debate. Why wouldn't you expect the same from
Castro? I think that this attack came off as a little bit meaner. I think the Harris attack was delivered somewhat respectfully. She kept talking about how much she respected Biden, whereas this seemed a little bit more backhanded. But I think it'll be interesting to see. Kamala Harris's favorables gained a lot of support, but also a not insignificant number of people started seeing her unfavorably after the debate. I wouldn't be surprised if Castro's unfavorable numbers go up after this, but also maybe his polling numbers will go up. Maybe those two things aren't mutually exclusive either. I just think it'll be really interesting. I think of all the candidates, they expect to stay roughly at about the same point in the polls, but I think Castro, if anybody moves, I think it might be Castro.
Moves up or down?
Either. I mean, there's not much room for him to move down, but in the horse race, but in the unfavorable ratings, I think that could.
Yeah, I think those go down. Yeah.
All right. As listeners know, we will be watching the polls as they come out in the coming days, and we will have a podcast out for you all this coming Monday. But it's getting late here in Houston, so I think it's time to wrap, and I want to get final thoughts from each of you before we go. Nate, take it away.
I mean, I don't know if my final thought after discussing this for half an hour is different than my first thought, where I don't see this debate as a major inflection point in the campaign. I am a little bit more willing than usually proven wrong, because you did have like lots of interesting things happen. They just kind of felt like they all kind of canceled out or didn't clearly like redound to any one candidate's benefit necessarily. I don't know. I mean, like the big meta question, I think, is like, what kind of risk does Joe Biden bear through continuously mediocre debate performances, right? What if this debate doesn't cost him much, but it costs him a point or something? That seems like a relevant question, potentially. Maybe just kind of being exposed to Warren. I mean, I don't know. I guess because, like, nothing that dramatic happened, to some extent, any moves you see in the polls might be fairly organic and not as bouncy, if that makes sense, right? Maybe it just happens that, like, you know, you have a debate. By the way, you'll probably get good ratings on a Thursday night. It's after Labor Day. People are watching TV more this time of year, right? So probably get good ratings, and we'll see. Maybe just kind of being exposed to a not particularly great night for Warren, but maybe she's just like, people like her when she debates, and maybe we'll see more movement toward her. So I don't know. It's not a very good takeaway, is it, Galen?
Well, I mean, then maybe just tell us, what's some advice on reading the polls after this? That it could still just be organic?
Yeah, my advice is look for whether you see continued. I mean, so one big argument is like, do you actually see continued decline for Biden, or is it just bouncing around between 28 and 30, depending on which kind of poll comes in, right? Is there a downward trend for Biden is, I think, maybe the more interesting polling question right now.
Sarah?
And I would say a continued climb for Warren, right? Like, she's the one candidate who's kind of consistently not had a huge surge at any one point, but just like climbed in the polls week to week. But I mean, okay, we went into this debate and we were like, is there going to be a Biden versus Warren showdown? There wasn't. Is there going to be a Warren versus Harris showdown? There wasn't. So overall, I thought, you know, this night of one debate, like, thank goodness, 10 candidates, one stage, would be a lot more impactful because, like, these were the 10 candidates who have polled the best. They cleared the 2% threshold. They got the 130,000 donors. But it was kind of underwhelming. And I don't know what that means in terms of, like, is it the race of 3, 4, 5 candidates? Does O'Rourke have a surge? Like, it's hard for me to imagine that this changes dramatically.
We've kind of said that during the primary, debates are the events that can move polls, because there are not that many big events that happen that all of the public comes together and pays attention to. If we just keep having debates like this, say, that are interesting, maybe substantive, not that remarkable, what does that mean? Joe Biden wins?
Brokered convention. I don't know.
I mean, I think the status quo right now is that Biden is maybe ticking down and Warren is ticking up. So if nothing interrupts that, then like we said, maybe eventually Warren overtakes him. But I would also have to think that that can't go on forever. So
you've had, I think, YouGov try to project out if you based on current polling, and they're more bullish on Warren than other pollsters. This is an important caveat, right? They kind of find based on current polling, if you try to project out delegates, that like Warren and Biden get the lion's share, Bernie gets a fair number, and no one else gets very much at all because they're below these 15% thresholds, except in certain states like Beto would win a few delegates in Texas or whatever.
And would that mean a brokered convention?
It would mean, I think, yeah. I mean, I think they do not have Biden getting a plurality, or a majority, rather, because you don't get away with a plurality, right? It'd be kind of weird, right? Like, if you have, like, I mean, that equilibrium is pretty unlikely to sustain itself, right? Like,
right, let's say you go through, out eventually.
Right, and it's Warren getting 4% of the delegates, Biden getting 38%, Bernie getting 16%, and others getting 6% or whatever. I mean, Bernie, you would think at that point, you would think would drop out and endorse Warren. It could literally, like, make her the nominee, if not president. You would think he would do that, so it's, like, a weird equilibrium to sustain. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, the one thing we can watch is, like, maybe the debate isn't going to move the needle much for ordinary rank-and-file voters. Will there be a concerted movement of what we call party elites, which you measure by endorsements or other things, to get behind, like, a Booker or a Klobuchar or maybe a Beto? But I think the former two are more likely.
We asked that question so many times during the 2016 election, and it never happened. And I just kind of, my base assumption is that it doesn't happen.
I know, but I think it matters more for Democrats than Republicans.
But like, I think the field is just too fractured for that, for there to be an overwhelming endorsement frontrunner. I do think it's interesting that Harris, I think, picked up a couple endorsements in recent days, and it'll be interesting to see. Like, I agree with Nate that, like, after a debate, if there are a couple of endorsements for somebody, that could be telling.
I mean, Harris really ticked down in the prediction markets over the course of the debate.
Really?
I'm changing my prediction to Harris lost the debate and therefore the nomination.
So you think that the Democratic Party is coordinated enough that it's more likely that the Democrats would do it than the Republicans in 2016?
I'm not saying it would work necessarily. I mean, like, a lot of what we're debating is, like, what are Booker's chances to become a player in the race where you're in the top three, and then maybe good things happen if you're in the top three, right? You know, what's the chance for any change, frankly, from the current dynamic where you have this kind of big 3.5, whatever you want to call it, or I optimistically maybe it won't hold up well, so it was a big 4.5 where Harris was part of the front-running group. I'm not sure she is anymore. I don't know, but we'll see.
Right. I mean, maybe one of the polling trends, as Nate mentioned earlier, is if Harris did do as poorly as we all initially think here, where do her voters go? And does that go to people who are Biden or Sanders, or does that actually go, and Warren, or does that go to lower polling candidates?
Interesting. I just want to check before we wrap up, Nate, how did the other movement play out unpredicted over the course of the evening?
Okay, so we're looking at Betfair, not predicted. Betfair, I think, is actually like a little bit better in the sense that you have more serious gamblers there and the structure's a little bit better, so sometimes the prices are more responsive, although we like our friends at predicted. Betfair had Warren up 1 point from 34 to 35, Biden up 1 from 22 to 23, Sanders down 1, Harris down 4, Beto up provisionally, or marginally, Booker up marginally. Yeah, so they mostly had like a bad night for Harris and a marginally good night for Warren and Biden relative to Sanders, all of which kind of seems...
Hey, I think we got this debate right. I don't know, go back and listen and see if our analysis made sense now that we gave you the answers to the question. No, I'm kidding. Do not put all of your trust in the betting odds in the half an hour after the debate wraps up.
I will say that after the first and second debates, I got the winners and losers totally wrong. So don't necessarily listen to what I have to say.
All right. After now listening to what you had to say, now you tell us. No, I'm kidding. All right. I think that's a wrap for this evening. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, other Nate.
Good night, Galen.
Sorry, no, I'm kidding. You're Nate one. We just heard from Nate.
I'm Nathaniel.
You're Nathaniel. Okay, fair enough. My name is Galen Drew. Kevin Ryder is on the controls here in Houston. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.